Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Happy Chef Uniforms, the perfect style, whatever your recipe. Visit happychef.com to order your free 2018 catalog.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, jumping in to tell you about this week's episode of Meat and Three, Heritage Radio Network's weekly food roundup. This week, we're introducing you to some amazing women taking a stand.
So often, being sexually harassed feels like a loss of control. And so I wanted to have these very tangible guides to say, here's what you can do.
Others are pushing for more diversity at major food industry events.
I still feel really determined to do, you know, whatever I can to help shift that and in a direction that's not just more diverse, but more equitable.
We also have a report on that summer business staple, the lemonade stand.
The lemonade stand might be the purest form of starting a business. Low overhead, easy to get into, and requires little experience or special equipment.
Don't miss Meat and Three, your weekly 15-minute food news roundup from HRN. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. Search MEAT plus sign THREE. And thanks, as always, for listening.
Hello, and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. On this week's episode, we are heading to Chicago, where we talk to Chef Diana Davila of Mitakaya, who is a recent winner of Food & Wine's Best New Chef. We talk to her about hearing the sauce and why touching tables is better than reading Yelp reviews. Then we have the band Drama, live in studio, who tells us why music is a job and why that's a good thing. So sit back, relax, and welcome to another edition of Snacky Tunes.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes. I said I didn't need you.
Loving you, I've been loving you.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. I am in a cold but clear day in Chicago, stranded from New York due to a storm. And I am sitting with Diana Davila Admitakaya Antaharia. Thanks for having me.
Hey, nice to be here.
Yes, we had a great dinner last night.
I'm glad you liked it. Yeah, it was really, I'm glad you came.
Yeah, the queso fundido with blood sausage is, I think I'm going to think about that. Is there just butter and everything?
There's no butter. You know, Mexican food doesn't have much butter at all. So that's just straight ooey gooey cheese and the moronga with the blood sausage. That's all just from pork fat. Mm.
It's so good. I was like, I think... It's like you can't do two of those, but you kind of want two of those. Because on the first one, you're just under, like, you're like, what am I eating? And yeah. I feel like it's like when I was a kid, I would get two slices of pizza. Just eat the first one, taste the second one.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And plus it has the little, like, the vegetable picklings to make you feel better about yourself after eating so much. to cut some acidity.
A little bit. So you started cooking when you were 17. And you used to go shopping with your dad at the markets. What was that like? Where would you go? What is the kind of... And your parents were here in Chicago, so what was the current food scene when your parents had their first restaurant?
So it was one of my favorite things to do, really, with my dad. You know, it was also kind of the time that I got to have, like, my one-on-one time, you know, because both my parents worked a lot, and between, you know, being in school and working a lot, it was, like, our time. And it was the funnest time, you know, like... What sucks about it is that, yeah, you have to wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning because, you know, you have to, at one point, you know, we had like 4 taquerias and we had this jalapenos van and we would go, all over Chicago, really, to pick up, you know, tomatoes, chiles, dried chiles, whoever had the new stuff, like the better quality, Fulton Market, Pilsen, Little Village. These were the places that we would always visit. But the funnest part about it was really that it would always turn into this kind of food extravaganza. Like, we would probably have, like, 4 breakfasts every Saturday because we were like, oh, there's la señora con los tamales, and we'd go get tamales. And then it's like, oh, this is my favorite spot to go get huevos rancheros from. You know, or, like, we'd always stop at different places to eat a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And, it was always my favorite. When it was cold, we'd get champurrado. When it was like, so it was like a very special time for me.
And what did that teach you about produce selection that you still carry on today? What are some of the lessons that you took from those experiences with your dad?
You know, he would, you know, as much as I want to be like, oh, he like handpicked, he was looking at price, you know, like my parents had this place to, I mean, to own a business to, it wasn't, I don't think he was looking to, other than avocados. Avocados were his thing. Like he would like, you know, I remember all the time he'd always be like, no, esos aguacates no están buenos. And, you know, like he'd be, you know, always arguing about avocados and like, he'd be like, well, I'm not going to buy it from you anymore. Like, and then we'd always be buying avocados from different places because I don't know if my dad was always just looking for a better price and good quality avocados or, he just, you know, bullied his way out of every place.
I think that story sometimes gets lost because everyone will say it's like they handpicked every grape and everything.
I'd love to romanticize that, but no cierto. Yeah, I'm going to be honest.
But I think, and also, like, we're talking that this is 20-something years ago where it's, like, it's a very different mm-hmm. atmosphere. And, you know, we'll update it with your current restaurant, but back then it's, like, it's price, the margin sheets, the price point for Mexican exactly. food at that time. And could you talk about... It'll explain what the perception of Mexican food was, which has, you know, for people who aren't aware, the second largest, mm-hmm. like, Mexican migrant population here. What was the current kind of scene for Mexican food when you were shopping with your father?
You know, again, like, it's funny because coming from, you know, I opened up a restaurant of my own for completely different reasons than what my parents opened up a restaurant for. So, like, to me, even when, you know, going around and, you know, places that we would eat. Like, a lot of those places are still there, you know, like from when I was growing up. So those places are still here, and they're still serving the same food. Like, but we would go to the mom-and-pop shops, you know, like, and a lot of those businesses are still there. And
what are some of your favorites?
The carnitas joint that we would go... And sometimes, you know what, honestly, sometimes I don't even know the name, you know, like... There was the original El Milagro place where they would make their, you know, it was like the first El Milagro Molino en Tortillería. We would get tacos there. We'd go to the Lalo's, which is actually like, it was a huge staple here in Pilsen. My mom, when she first came to the States, she was actually a server there, which is so funny. This one place called Mi Casa, Mi Pueblo that had, like, it was just a bunch of, like, mothers and abuelas making, like, these guisados and stews. And so these places are still there, you know. I didn't, you know, at the time, my parents would always, like, take us out to eat from small mom-and-pop shops to, like, my mom was always, like, this magazine hoarder where she would... Be like, what's the new hot restaurant? What's the, you know, Chicago Magazine? And we would always go, and she would take us kids, you know. So I think I was always kind of exposed to all different sorts of different kinds of restaurants. But we never actually went to, like, upscale Mexican restaurants. It wasn't until, actually, you know, Topolobampo, Frontera Grill by Rick Bayless. That was kind of my first, I want to say I was like maybe 14. Yeah, I had to have been like 14 or 13 years old the first time that they took me there. And I loved it. My mom loved it. We were all very like proud and happy, you know, like this is so cool. You know, like I love this. And, you know, like, yeah, this reminds, and also because the staff mostly are Mexican. One of them is actually from... San Luis Potosí, that through the years when I would go to Topolobampo, he would always be there and would be like, yeah, San Luis Potosí. Like, so, you know, what was the food scene like for, you know, up and coming restaurant? I'm not sure, but I know that that was the first place that I remember going to as the upscale Mexican food kind of ordeal.
After you worked in your parents' restaurant, you decided to go to culinary school. And most of the places you hear about New York or they go to the Cordon Bleu or anything, you went to Mexico. You went to go cook in Oaxaca. What was that experience? What was that decision? And what do you feel that you maybe learned there that your counterparts who went to culinary school in America or London and Paris mm-hmm. didn't necessarily have?
You know, it's funny because when I had the moment where I'm like, oh, I want to be a chef, I didn't... I went to an all-girl, like, Catholic high school, and I didn't know one person who wanted to be, like, so, like, I felt kind of alone. I didn't even tell anybody for a long time because I'm like, okay, so I have this like larger than life moment where I know like that I have this calling, but now what the fuck do I do? You know, like, and I kind of just was like,
And this is early 2000s, late 90s or 2000s?
Late 90s, yeah. And so I kept it to myself, and to me, I was like, oh, you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to start, again, since I went out to eat a lot with my parents, and I'm like, I'm just going to, you know, knock on their door and be like, hey, I want to be a cook. Can I work here? And that's what I ended up doing. But like when I finally did tell my parents, I thought that they were going to be like, that's not a real job. You know, you should be a lawyer. You should be this. And they were super excited. And they were like, oh, well, my mom was like, took it and really flew with it. She was like, you should go to Paris, go to Europe and blah, blah, blah. And I was like your typical teenage girl who was totally fancied up with her now husband, but then boyfriend. We're like, but I'm going to miss my boyfriend. I don't want to go to Europe. How fucking ridiculous. I one of the most ridiculous things I've ever said. I'm like, ugh. Like me, 35 years old, looking back, we're like, what a stupid girl.
You're gonna marry him. Go
but
to Europe.
The story gets better, right? Yeah. Like, so it wasn't a mistake, right? But like, who passes up an opportunity like that?
Kids do.
Right. Exactly.
Because we don't know.
But and again, funny enough, when I went to, it's not that I didn't seek going to Oaxaca for schooling. My mother actually told me, again, there's a lot of women in my family who very much love cooking and Mexican cuisine in general. Like women in my, I don't have much family here. Mostly everybody's in Mexico and San Luis. And my aunt actually told my mom about this. And this school called Seasons of My Heart from Susana Trilling in Oaxaca. But really, she just wanted me to go there. It was her idea. She's like, hey, I'm paying for you to go to Oaxaca. You're going to stay there. You're like, Oaxaca is this beautiful, has so much culture and food, and you're going to love it. I'm like, cool, great. You know? And so I went there, and, it wasn't so much, you know, at that school, it was the first year she actually opened the school. It was, and so, you know, like not, I don't know. It was like the first year. So there was a lot of things that happened.
Year
so,
one
right.
of anything.
Exactly. And, you know, like I really got to me, the best part was really, again, I didn't know it at the time. I just knew I wanted to be a chef and be, you know, had to work on my craft. And I didn't think at the time that, oh, I want to cook Mexican food or this is what I want to do. You know, that moment happened later, but I loved it. I mean, the, Oaxaca has such a beautiful, beautiful, for somebody who, you know, I view myself as an artist, for somebody who is very impressionable, like it's like candy, you know, it's like a kid in a candy store. There's so much, history, language, music, textures, clothing, artesanías, like clay and pottery and food. And it was amazing.
You talk about, we always juxtapose the how similar chefs and musicians are. Mm-hmm. You talk about hearing the sauce. You've been well quoted on it. Can you maybe define that a little bit and what it is that, how you could translate that to like kind of being, this is what I want to do. This is cemented by hearing the sauce.
No, I think it's something like when you're focused on what it is that you're doing, you kind of give yourself the ability to be in tune, you know, with what you're doing. And you, that's when you really start feeling and hearing and using, having your five senses open. And that's what that moment was for me. I was making huevos motuleños, and I was just really into what I was making and really like, it's like when you have an out of body experience, and I'm like literally looking at myself and I'm like, like I could hear, I could touch the oils that are coming out of the peppers that I'm cleaning. I have the chorizo that like I could hear start sizzling in the pan, and like it like, you know, morphing into something else. You know, like I could see the tomatoes like releasing their sugars and charring, and you know, like hearing the salt. Like, so it's like really being in tune with what you're doing and being able to kind of lose yourself in that moment, and using your five senses. You know, and that's somewhere during that, that's when it came to me. I'm like, I want to be a chef.
Your journeys from leaving Mexico to Mitakaya is pretty well traced. There is one thing that I was curious about. When your parents opened Hacienda Jalapenos, there was an executive chef that was in place. I read that you alluded to that you kind of got them removed, pushed out. What were your methods and what was your point of view? You were all of 20 at a time or 21 thinking that you could run your parents' restaurant. What did you do to get the chef out, and what did you do to convince your parents that you could helm the ship?
You know, it wasn't out of savviness. That's the thing, you know, and it, even that, like I was at the time, my parents are, you know, like radical hippies in many ways. You know, they're, you know, some people have these like crazy ideas. They're the people who just like throw themselves in front of them and do it. And they're like, oh, we want to have, you know, like a upscale Mexican restaurant, you know, like, you know, and I'm like, yeah, that's great. You know, that's a lot of work. That's not like what you guys do with your taquerias. And so they got this big space and they were in it, and they're like, yeah, you know, like we want you to be the chef. And I'm, you know, being that I'm so modest, I was like, no, no, me, I can't, you know, like, but really it was coming from being honest. I'm like, no, you know, like I don't know. I don't have something to say yet. Like I'm cooking, and you know, like I'm a line cook. I'm not, you know, I don't want to have that responsibility, nor do I think I'm ready. But I'm like, find somebody. I'll be the sous chef. Right. I'm like, I'll be the sous chef, you know, like, so they found somebody. And again, and it wasn't, you know, anything I do, I go into it with best intentions and that, like, so it wasn't like, oh, I have to get this person out of it. Like, but I just kind of came to realize, I think my parents as well, like all parties involved, for the chef, for my parents, for myself, kind of started realizing that, you know, he was not the best person for the job, that it was something that I should do. And that's kind of what happened. And I wasn't, in the beginning, I wasn't thinking that I was prepared. But as I was doing it, I'm like, yeah, you know what? I could do this. I do know what I'm doing. And I could create things, and I could, you know, like really. And so it just kind of happened, you know, like I didn't really seek out to do it.
Do you remember the first dish, and maybe it was there, maybe learned that you created that felt was the first thing to tell your story?
Well, I didn't have, you know, like, I know, I remember some sauces that like I would do that. I think, it's funny to see, I don't know about telling, you know, I didn't have a story to tell. I was still very much finding myself, but, sauces like, blood orange guajillo salsa, that I did with like, lutamer, like I still remember thinking about that and, thinking like I had never at that point, I had never even had a fucking blood orange. Why I thought of that, like, I don't know. And I think that it's like one of those things where sometimes I'm like so scared to, sometimes I would think of ingredients that I may not have never tried or eaten before, but imagine them into like, I did like a blackberry pasilla mole. Like, I'm like, I've never saw those things together before. Why I thought to put that into a play, I don't know. It came from something, you know, and I get scared thinking that, that you could lose that, you know, that, I don't know. I don't know if it's a talent or a skill or imagination, but like sometimes I don't even like talking about it. Cause what if one day I wake up and I lose it. And then it's like, shit, you know, like, I don't want to lose that. Like, yeah, I don't want to put that into, I don't know. It's scary, but it's also, when I look back and I think of those things, I'm like, oh yeah, that was a really great sauce. You know, like,
we're going to take a quick musical break, play a song from the archives, and then we'll be back here on Snacky Tunes. Mitakaya has been open for almost a year. A lot of the things that you were kind of facing coming into this is a similar argument or kind of discussion we've had from other, I don't want to say high-end Mexican chef, but people who are fighting against Mexican food being secondary, made with cheap ingredients, pricing. When you were putting together the concept for the restaurant, how did you begin to approach and what kind of ideas did you put together to be able to combat that tacos are cheap, it's the same type of food, it's the same items being served, and how did you begin to differentiate yourself from the rest of the landscape here?
Sometimes it's not... I think first and foremost, especially, I had said that I had that moment when I wanted to be a chef. I had a second moment when I had this moment again, very similar, where I was like, I want to be a Mexican chef. This is the food I want to dedicate the cuisine I want to dedicate my life to growing, to learning, to explore, so honestly, I didn't have the plan to be like, oh, well, I want this to say this, or it comes from really just as a cook who wants to like play out her ideas and cook this food and share it. All the rest of the stuff that comes with it, like I didn't have a plan like, oh, this is this. And like, you know, that's what I put out there. You know, like I put out like, this is, oh, like, oh, I want to make this dish, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, like, then you create it, and then the rest of the stuff is secondary, you know, so it's more like, you know, oh, people are saying that tacos, you know, like, I used to read Yelp reviews every day, and, like, answer them back personally, and then finally I'm like, this is retarded, this is not the way I run my business. I run my business with the people who are in here, and if you could, you know, I touch like probably 80% of the tables, and I also talk to the staff every day. Like, if you feel that somebody is not happy or something is happening or like whatever it may be, you know, like we deal with this in-house. I don't deal with it with another forum like Yelp, you know, like I encourage people to speak up, you know, not leave and go hide and write on their computers. I find that really I don't really appreciate that, you know, like it, when you see a menu and you see that it's $4 for a taco, like almost everybody looks at menus before they go in. If you have a problem with it and you like, then don't come, you know, like it's your choice, you know, like, cause my pricing isn't going to change. Like you do not know how much I spend or how much time or what, like, so, I mean, if you really feel that raw about it,
don't
there's
come.
There's a lot of places you could go get your cheap taco. And to me, it's, do I think that there's a sort of stigma of like that Mexican food should be cheap? Yes, very much so. And I find it, insulting, really. You know, I find it very much insulting. Somebody who has, researched a lot and who feels very strongly and knows where things come from and knows the time and the elements and the beauty, the complexity. And I find it to be very insulting that somebody could sit there and be like, well, Mexican food should be cheap. I don't care if you raise the chicken yourself. The taco shouldn't be. I'm not paying more than $2. I could go down the street. I'm like, right, of course. Exactly. You can. You know, like, and those are the people who are catering to the Mexican, like to the American palate that are like, yeah, you know, like they're running a business. They're not doing it for, you know, like it's like my parents when they had the restaurant, it was so they could have, sure, there's a couple dishes that were very special to them and they would create, but they, you know, they were doing like, hey, yeah, like this is the price that we're going to do. This is what we're going to like, you know, it's hard, you know, and I really do find it insulting because people will go to places like huge corporate places and pay $24 for shitty pasta, canned tomato sauce, but it's in a big bowl and it has a sprig of parsley and shitty manufactured Parmesan cheese. Not even, you know, like pay $24 for that. $24. And you want to tell me that $4 for a taco of, you know, smoked beer can chicken that is like, I care about my ingredients. Everything is like, that takes time. That's too much to pay for four. Like, I cannot see that. That's why it's insulting for me. Like, I really feel that, and it's racist. It's racist. It's insulting. And I think that people should really think before they speak.
You mentioned not adjusting your menu for the American palate. Your menu is great. It's really adventurous. It's awesome. But it's also a lot of classic Mexican ingredients. Grasshoppers, I think, was like the third menu item. Have you seen a lot of people be surprised and delighted by the flavors they haven't tried? Have you seen the positive side of just being, this is what we eat, please come experience this if you want something dumbed down, covered in cheese, outside the queso fundido? What are some of the more positive you've seen in the year that you've been open?
I don't want to sound like if I'm like this, you know, like, I opened this place for to have the opportunity, the ability to be able to create food, to cook, to you know, and like, it is my outlet and what I want to share with people. Like, even the queso fundido, sometimes people think like, oh, well, that's just a dish that everybody... No, the queso fundido actually is a... I love that dish because it's a dish that my grandmother would always make for our cena at night. Like, she would do queso fundido, nice cheese with like chorizo, handmade flour tortillas. Like, it's... So everything comes from something. You know, for me, it's a way of sharing what I love. It's like having, like, for a painter, you know, having an art gallery, you open it up and you share where you are, you share your art, you share your love, you share, you know, like, so to me, that's what it's about, you know. For, you know, I want people to come here to people who are, you know, like, if you want to come here, it's to experience. Just like anytime when I go to a restaurant, I'm like, oh, that sounds really good. I want to go and taste. I want to taste it. Like, I want to go. You know, like, it sounds, sometimes it can sound bad when it's like, oh, you're not doing it to cater to the American palate. It's like, well, I'm not cooking food that people it's not like this market research. This is what the people want right now. To me, it's, this is what I want to make and I want to share. And I welcome people to come in to, if that's something that interests you and that you want to taste, awesome, come.
It's more like, it just so happens that what you're cooking, people want to eat. And a lot of people want to eat it, but you'd still be cooking this if there was 100 people or one person.
Exactly. Yes.
Which is great because I love grasshoppers and chicken livers and two types of stewed meats and two different types of moles. And it's amazing because last night was difficult because there were just two of us and we couldn't narrow it down, which is, and not because it was such, it's a big menu, but it's almost like, can we just run everything? Let's just take one of everything.
And tasting portion of everything.
We actually sent the server back twice because we're like, we're here. We just have to. And we just went back. And it was really good because it speaks to a strong menu. But also, everything was different. That's the thing I think that I saw on the menu is that there wasn't like, oh, it's like four dishes that kind of taste the same. Everything we tasted had its own distinct flavor. And it wasn't copied on the next dish, which is really amazing. One of the other things that you've talked about in the makeup of Mexican cooking is the kind of disproportionate ratio of men cooking Mexican food professionally versus how many men actually cook it
privately. You're really gunning for me. People are going to hate me.
I don't know that if it's gunning for it. I think it's like there's it's about opportunity. It's about trust. It's about seeing yourself in, you know, the marketplace or the business. So it's interesting to see that you've brought up that 95% of the women who cook in Mexico are in the home, and a majority of the people who cook Mexican are males. How do you kind of rationalize that, and how do you see changes to that, both from the work environment that you have and opportunities that you provide for women coming up through the culinary world?
You know, I think that, you know, when I, you know, because, again, when I take a look at it, well, how did this come to be, or how, like, and you know, how did this come to be? You know, like, people are like, oh, have you noticed that, you know, the Mexican restaurants in Chicago, they're all male, you know, whether they're Mexican chefs or, you know, non-Mexican, but it gets dominated by that. And I'm like, well, I guess, you know, so it makes me start to kind of see and like, oh, and like most of the places I've been to, you know, like most of the places I've been to and I've tasted and like, you know, I would say that I just know from as a cook sometimes as, so this is the way kind of like I could see how this happens, you know, when Mexicans come to Chicago and they start getting jobs and like there's a huge obviously workforce and there's a place, huge market for restaurants, right? So they go to these restaurants, they become cooks for a job, right? And they start learning how to cook with whoever they're working or whatever restaurant, you know, like, and they start to learn how to do the how to cook, right? As for a job. And sometimes, like, I've seen it many times where they'll be like, oh, well, make something Mexican because you're Mexican. Like, and they won't know how to do it, like, because they've never cooked their own food. Their wife or their daughter or their mother is the one that does the cooking. So they don't, just because you're Mexican doesn't mean you know how to cook Mexican food. That's not what that means, you know, like. They start cooking, and they also don't, you know, their machismo is real, you know, like, they're not going to go home and ask their wife or their significant, you know, like, they're like, oh, well, how do you make this rice, or how did you do that? Like, no, they just start cooking the way, like, what they learn and put in, you know, so you kind of lose this sense of, you know, and the same question gets kind of applied to when you start, seeing when you ask, when people ask chefs, oh, well, what inspired you or how did you start cooking? I'd say that 9 times out of 10, it's my mother, my aunt,
my grandmother.
And a lot of times it's the seed of how chefs first wanted to cook, to emulate the food that they're, or how they're feeling, how their mother cooked or how they felt or what that dish was, or like, you know, and it's kind of funny, you know. And so for me, like, I also had like, I think as I got older, I've really embraced my knowing what is a, you know, like what a woman is, my inner woman, who me being a woman. And when I start asking myself all these questions and kind of see, like, it, and also during this, like, once I, like, kind of had 2 children, like, it, the whole process really was such a beautiful, it's so beautiful, and I've really embraced my womanhood, and with cooking as well, you know, like, so when you ask, like, where's your favorite Mexican restaurant? It's my mom's house, or, oh, it's my aunt's. People always say that, and that's something that I wanted Mi Tocaya to be, like, I am a Mexican mother. I'm a Mexican-American mother. And I want this place to be, you know, the food that your mother made, your grandmother made, your aunt made. Like, because those are the things, that's who I channel. And that's who I, you know, so that's what it means to me. And I learned how to cook with these women, you know, and all throughout my life. You know, I spent summers in Mexico. And my aunt would loved to cook, and would every time that we would go to different places, whether it was Chihuahua or Veracruz or Oaxaca or Monterrey or Tampico, or, you know, like, we would always make it a point to, like, she would make it a point to go to those markets to, like, ask, oh, ¿cómo haces esa salsa? How do you make that sauce? And, like, and I would be with her, you know, like, I was her gal pal. She had 3 boys, and I was, like, her, like, gal pal, you know, like, and I loved it. And so I remember all this, and that's what I channel, and I learned with her, like, oh, that's how you make that, like, that's how you do this, like, that's how, and so, I think a lot of times when we think about, like, that food that your mother made, or that food that, like, my kids ask me, like, they're like, oh, we went to Abuelas, and she makes the same dish, the same guisado de res that you make, isn't that funny, like, it was, because that's really the food that I'm making here. It's based off of that. So it's like it's the food. It's like here, Mi Tocaya, like my alter ego, is the melding of the professional cook and the home cook. And what a beautiful thing that is, you know?
You have 2 kids. Do you cook with them? Do you have similar shopping moments like you do with your dad? Are they hunting for the best avocados at 4 a.m. on Saturdays?
Yes. Yes. You know, the other day, sometimes, you know, and it's sometimes I have to stop myself because, you know, I'm like tenderizing meat for making tacos árabes, and I'm like going to be skewering them like a kebab, like sort of a mini al pastor. And I had my son, because I'm like prepping, and I bring my son with me, you know, to the restaurant, and he's like, oh, I want to help. Can I help you, Ma? Can I help you, Mama? And I'm just like, oh, he's not going to know how to do this. He's going to ruin the meat or blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, you can help, you know, like, and like, I just kind of set him up as a station and like give him the hammer and be like, this is what we're doing. This is why. And it becomes beautiful. And maybe, you know, like, and those are the moments that I remember sometimes. So like, first, immediately, I'm like, the like professional cook, I'm like, no, you're going to slaughter the product. You're like, no, like, but then all of a sudden the mother in me is like, no, yes, help, because energy is translucent, you know, like it transcends. And it actually everything ended up tasting beautifully, and he was a part of it, you know, and that's awesome. And there are little things like that, you know, like, making chochoyotes, like, and Adriana's like, I want to help. Can I do it? And I'm like, oh, yeah, professional. I'm like, no, you're not gonna be able to do this. This takes high skill. And I'm like, bullshit. You know, like, this is how you learn. This is how you learn. Who am I to tell you what she can't, if she could roll a ball or not, you know? And she did, you know? And there are little things, like, I have those moments all the time, and it's great.
It's the balance of the home and the professional.
Yeah.
Well, Chef, thank you for making time for me. Where can people find you? Where can they make reservations? Instagram, etc. How do they find you?
From my home away from another home at Mitokai at 2800 West Logan Boulevard. I'm always here. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and we always post really fun moments of us and at our Mitokaya family.
We're going to take another quick musical break from the archives, and then we'll be back with the second half of Snacky Tunes.
Anyway.
Maybe you're looking for a coat for yourself, or you want a bold look for your staff. You might even need a new style for your restaurant, whether it's modern, industrial, or farm-to-table. Whatever you're looking for, Happy Chef has got you covered. Their wide variety of chef apparel and products are perfect for teams of all sizes and styles. And with the industry's easiest custom embroidery, you can add your logo, name, or fun artwork to many of their other products in minutes. Here's what you do. Visit happychef.com and choose from their incredible selection. With only a couple clicks, you can customize many of their products to personalize your look. Right now, they're even offering free custom logo setup on all orders over $150, a $95 value totally free. Visit happychef.com now to order your free 2018 catalog featuring new styles and incredible comfort. Happy Chef, the perfect style, whatever your recipe.
Welcome back to the show. We have Niall and Via from Drama here with us in studio on Snacky Tunes. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
We are big fans of you two and have been listening for well over last year, so we are excited to have you on and playing for us today. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah. Sweet, thank you.
So Via, you actually went to culinary school when you were living out in Hollywood. How did you end up there, and what took you on that path?
I've been cooking since I was maybe like 9 years old. My parents were in a reggae band, and there wasn't a lot of time, most of the time, to cook because they were like rehearsing or on tour. And so I just started cooking. And so when I came of age to like, you know, start deciding what I was going to do with my life, they were like, well, why don't you go to culinary school? And I was like, that's a good idea. And so when I was like 16, instead of going to like high school, I went to culinary school because I was like homeschooled up until then. And they enrolled me in a holistic nutrition program in Berkeley. And I graduated from that when I was 17. And then when I was done with that, my dad was like, well, if you really want to do this, you should just keep going until you're ready to, like, open a restaurant. And so he put me in another culinary school in Hollywood. And, you know, graduated from there and just kind of started working in restaurants.
What was the name of the culinary schools?
Le Cordon Bleu. It was right off of Sunset.
And what year was this?
I think they changed it.
Yeah, what year was this, and what was the culinary scene
2009.
Out? 2009. Oh, okay.
2009.
So kind of not the beginning, but close to the beginning of what we are currently experiencing in the modern food scene.
Yeah, I guess so.
What were some of the things that you learned in culinary school that you felt applied to your music making?
Oh, man, I don't know. Maybe having to make recipes. But even then, my music wasn't as structured as my recipe. So, I don't know. I feel like I kind of kept those worlds separate for a long time.
Were you performing when you were in culinary school?
Oh, no. I didn't start doing shows until I was like 24 or so. Maybe I did my first show when I was like 24.
So was
I didn't want to be on stage anymore. I was like, I had started off in theater when I was little. And so I was doing a lot of plays and doing like sound and prop design and stage design for a company called Zachary Scott Theater in Austin, Texas. And so I honestly don't remember what happened. I just know that something happened and I did not want to be on stage anymore. And so I never planned on getting back on stage again. And the music just kind of led me back to the stage.
What was the defining moment that got you back to the stage and out of the kitchen? And did you really feel that you were going to go on the path to become a chef, open a restaurant, create your own menus, cook for a living?
Well, I never really knew that I was going to do that. That was just something that I knew came with being a chef. And everyone kind of expected me to open a restaurant. They were just kind of like, oh, well, you're a chef, so when are you going to open your restaurant? And I was like, I don't know. But I don't think I ever really wanted to open a restaurant, like, really. It was just, like, a nice idea. Especially after I got out of culinary school and all my teachers scared the crap out of me. Like, you want to commit suicide? Don't open a restaurant right now. And I was like, okay. But
so it's like, I'll take the other sure thing. I'll become a musician.
Yeah. But I still worked in restaurants, though, because it was, you know, the only training that I really had. I didn't have musical training, and I didn't go to, like, college or middle school or, like, high school or anything. The only thing that I've ever learned is cooking. And then, like, you know, being homeschooled, I learned, like, simple math and history and stuff like that. But I was not paying attention. I was like doing essays on chipmunks and stuff, like whatever I wanted to learn about. But I didn't like take music serious until I moved to Chicago. Before then, it was just kind of something that I did on my journey to becoming the best chef in the world.
And now you own three restaurants alongside being a producer, right?
Me?
Yeah.
He does. And one's in San Francisco and two in Illinois. How did you come to own these restaurants, and where did the concepts come from? And they're across the board too. It's Mediterranean, South American, and Mexican.
Yeah. At some point in my music career, I wanted to like diversify a little bit. So after I finished a couple of projects, I was working on some projects, and then I was like, I'm kind of like, you know, like I don't want to say like I lost passion, but I just needed something else to do at this little like transition period. Because I was like, you know what, music is cool. You know, I've done really well. I want to try to see if I can, you know, tackle something new. And that's what I did. And I had an opportunity. I got a phone call and it was like, hey, we're opening up a restaurant. Would you be interested, you know, in being like 50% owner? So I was like, yeah, sure. Absolutely, man. Well, and then I got into the restaurant business, and for some reason I feel like the restaurant business and the music business are very much alike. They're probably the most difficult fields to get into and to like maintain and, you know, and to do. So I started off in the first one was a South American restaurant, and then two years later, there was another opportunity to open up a Mediterranean restaurant, and so I jumped on that right away, and I came up with, you know, with a lot of the recipes and the concepts, and then I got another opportunity. I got a phone call. Somebody wanted me to consult them on a restaurant in San Francisco, and I ended up being a partner with them after everything was said and done. So,
and what
that was like Mexican fusion food. And so like what I did was, me and Via were working on drama stuff, and I was like, hey, you're a chef. Why don't you come, you know, help me out? And we started working together on it, and now we have an amazing restaurant in San Francisco.
And what was it about your background that prompted that first phone call? Did your family own restaurants, or did they just think that you had a creative eye and they knew that you would be good for the culinary world?
I'm more of a businessman. I know how to build teams. And so like my thing is that I don't, like, I'll do anything it takes not to fail. Like, I'll do whatever, like, I'll work, you know, 24 hours in a day if I have to, you know, and I'll do whatever it takes. But like, when I got that phone call, I was like, hey, this is a good opportunity. I can go ahead and, you know, learn, and I can, you know, figure this out. I didn't realize how hard it was until I got into it. You know, I've heard it was, you know, it's a very hard business. It's a very difficult business, but I was like, hey, I'm going to go ahead and take a stab at it. And I was still doing music. Like, it wasn't like I stopped. I had a studio, and I was still booking with artists and doing like recordings and mixing and engineering records. But I would like work at the restaurant during the day and then work on music stuff during the night. But I just did it, you know, like I wanted to explore other fields. And so I invested my money, and then that was it.
And since you work on music together and also you work on a restaurant together, is there any difference in the creative process in creating a dish or creating a song?
There are similarities to working in the restaurant. I mean, it teaches you about patience. It teaches you about just dealing with certain things. And that does kind of apply. It does fall over into making music and, you know, and producing a project. So just organization, being a team player, you know, like as the group is getting bigger, more people are being involved. So it's just knowing how to like delegate and be able to work with certain people and keep things moving in a positive way, you know?
Right. If you can get food out on the table that's consistent and good, you can definitely help manage a tour.
Exactly. Absolutely. So I mean, like with me, it's like nothing's impossible, you know? I do whatever it takes to get the job done, you know, and a lot of it has to do with not having any pride. Honestly, it's like saying, you know what, I'm going to put my pride aside. I'm going to do whatever it takes to make sure that this is a successful, a successful project or like outcome or whatever it may be.
Can we hear a song?
Yeah.
What are you going to play for us first?
We're going to play Fuck Dave.
Okay. Well, here we are with Drama live on Snacky Tunes.
Loving you is cold. Loving you is lonely. Loving you is pointless. Loving you is holding me back inside. Oh, I'm back in line. And loving you is cold. Loving you is lonely. Loving you is pointless. Loving you is holding me back inside. Oh, I'm back. Loving you is lonely, loving you is pointless. Loving you is holding me back inside. Oh, I'm back in line. Fade, forgive me, I've been sinning. True love was a friend of mine. I chose my fate, forgive me, I've been sinning. True love was a friend of mine.
Now, one of the things that I thought was most interesting when you were young and early in your production career, Nicholas Jaar told you that you should really release your own music. I'm very curious, what does a Nicholas Jaar pep talk sound like?
It's very short, I'll tell you that. No, I met him through a mutual friend, Summy, and he wanted to get us together. At the time, I was working on Asta Rap, the Chance Rapper project, and he played at Sound Bar or Spy Bar here in Chicago. And I'm like, I don't really go out much. So I was like, hey, man, you know, like, I'm going to go hear this guy play. I hear so much hype about this guy. So when I saw him play, he came by my office the next day. And we talked for about maybe an hour to two hours. And I was just showing him music, you know. And then he looked at me. He's like, how come you don't put your own records out? And I looked at him. I was like, honestly, I really don't know. I just never looked at myself of putting, like, my just music out, you know, just under my name. I've always worked under someone else, either, you know, a rapper, a label, you know, whatever, like whoever hires me, like, kind of thing, you know. But like, I rarely took on, like, I never thought about becoming an artist, really, you know. Like, I was an artist, but not like an artist to go out there and tour like what I'm doing now. But he was just like, he's like, how come you put your records out? And I was like, that's not a fucking bad idea. And so it was just him saying that because I really liked his set the night before, and I saw that he went on stage, he played these records. I was like, this is fucking awesome. I'm like, I can do something like this. And then I just did it.
It sounds like both of you were reluctant to become stars or musicians with yourselves at the forefront. Do you think that's what drew yourselves to each other, or that's the commonality found in how you created this group?
I think that it definitely makes it easier for me to be working with someone who also doesn't necessarily want to be, like, you know, in the spotlight or a megastar and doesn't really care about all the flashy things that most people get in the music industry for. Like, when I was younger, being a musician wasn't, like, glorified for me. It wasn't something that, like, I woke up and thought, I'm going to be a superstar. I'd dance in front of the mirror and prance around and pretend I'm on stage. Like, I didn't want anything to do with being on tour and having to deal with musicians wanting more money and, like, you know, festival producers not paying you at the end of the day. Like, I saw the worst of the worst when it came to my experiences, like, watching musicians grow. And so when it came for my turn, people were like, I'm going to go to South By and move to L.A. I'm like, why are you doing that? And this didn't make any sense. When I met Niall and he wanted to start a group, I was like, all right, well, you're going to be on stage with me. And he was like, no. I was like, yes, now we can both not really want to do this, but we're going to do it.
What, I mean, what are your pep talks or what are your pre-show rituals to get each other psyched up to be on a place that you don't necessarily want to be?
We call each other potatoes. Come on, Papa, get on stage.
We just motivate each other. Say, so like, you're ready, you know, like, yeah. Let's just do whatever we have to do. I mean, honestly, it's really hard to, like, gauge, you know, like, when you're on stage, like, you don't, you know, like, you want to give it your all, and you want to, you look at the crowd to see if they're feeling it, you know, and it's still, to this day, to me, shocking when we go to these shows. Like, New York was sold out. I was like, I can't believe these many people came out to see us play. It still shocks me, you know?
Yeah. I think once, like, all of the anxiety and the fear and the not really wanting to do it is only before and after. Like, once I think we're actually on stage,
it's a whole different world.
It's just kind of like, oh, we're just up here hanging out, no matter what, and it's actually a lot of fun. Then afterwards, you're like, oh my gosh, can't believe I just did that.
Yeah.
Ready for bed.
It's like another part of your brain takes over. You're like, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. You black out.
I get so nervous right before I go on stage. Like, I said, stomach shake sometimes.
It's the worst. This might be too much. I use the bathroom like every 5 seconds, and our tour manager gets so upset because he's literally having to, like, to walk me through the crowd to get back to the bathroom sometimes. I'm like, I can't help it. I'm so nervous.
You'll know that you've achieved a next level when your green room has a bathroom and you don't have to cut through the crowd.
I know. We have a few, and it's like a breath of fresh air.
Yeah. You're like, my rider is a green room. Yeah, my rider is a green room with a bathroom.
My rider is a green room in the bathroom. And an actual green room, please. One that allows actual greens.
Can we hear another song?
Yeah, absolutely.
What are you going to play for us?
This one, we're going to play Low Tide.
Low Tide. Keeping it chill.
I'm not just anybody. No, my love won't be taken down by a bullet. And I've tried everything, but I'm best at disappearing. And your love used to bring out the best in me. And now I'll be dying when I am reminded. Love to remind me that you're too cool to fall in love. You're too smooth to get caught up in something you can't walk away from. Don't walk away from me. And I know it's safer to believe that you don't mean a thing to me, but I'm a fool, and I'm in love. I'm a fool, and I'm caught up, and I can't walk away. Can't walk away from you. So say, oh, what you're going to say to me, and I'll remember. And I'll meet you in the low tide, low tide. And I'll meet you in the low tide, low tide. And I'll meet you in the low tide, low tide.
And I'll meet you in the low tide, low tide, in the low tide, in the low tide. And I'll meet you in the low tide, in the low tide.
So you just have a new EP come out called Lies After Love. You talk about it being a much more formal process than the previous record. What was the approach and what did you learn from the last time, and what did you do differently on this one?
I think things, we kind of went into it the same exact way we went into Gallup. The thing with us is like we continuously like make music. So we just work on music and then eventually it starts to piece itself together.
Yeah. The conversations we have outside of making the music piece the actual project together, because the project's always based on our actual lives. Like, it's always that. So the music comes first, and then, you know, piecing together everything else comes after. But I think the one thing that changed with this would be that, well, I can say that for Niall, because Niall spends 50 hours on all the songs no matter what. But so, like, we both, you know, took a little more time with the songs on this one, and like each individual song, and like going back and recording things and changing like bass lines or drum patterns, and as opposed to the first one with just like lots of freestyles and first takes and, you know, just going with the flow.
Do you ever, are you ever in the working together on making a recipe and you have to stop because you find song inspiration, or vice versa?
I never really thought about that, actually.
No, we keep a lot of it separate.
Yeah.
Like, even though we might talk about the thing, like, we'll be doing music and we talk about, like, how we have restaurants, we'll be doing restaurants and, like, playing our music at the restaurant, but we never are, like, at the restaurant talking about rehearsal or at rehearsal talking about the restaurant.
I'm sure.
Unless it's, like, an emergency. Yeah. We get a phone call at the music video and we're like, we have to fly to San Francisco right now.
Yeah.
Which has happened before.
Yeah, which has definitely happened before.
But it's not too much of, like, you know. But my notebook is definitely filled with recipes on one page and song lyrics on the other.
You're like, oh, wait a second. These lyrics are actually just a chicken adobo recipe. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, an English pea soup with cardamom actually would be perfect with this song right now.
I've always thought, you know, everyone knows about the car test for playing your music, but I've actually never heard about the restaurant test. Do you play your songs or tracks in the restaurant just to see people's reactions?
Oh, yeah,
before you release
all the time.
Really?
All the time. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
All the time. And people walk in, or they're eating, and they come up to it, like, oh, what are you guys playing right now? I'm like, oh, this band, Drama.
Yeah.
They're pretty good. So you should check them out.
Do you ever, has there been any tracks that you were both split on, like, should it make it on the P or not, and you play it, and it didn't make the cut because people's reactions were subpar?
I've played some songs live prior, and just to kind of gauge, you know, but for the most part, I mean, either it goes, like, on this EP or it goes, like, on a future EP, you know? Like, we really make music, like, we just don't, like, you know, like, how Beyonce, like, makes, like, 1,000 songs before she does her album. Like, we make songs, but, like, the majority of the time go on a project always,
yeah,
for the most part, you know? I would say, like, maybe 75 or 80% of the songs that we make don't go wasted, yeah, at all.
Why do you think that is, or what do you think it is about the process that just gets those songs out there, as opposed to, you know, you hear people make, like you said, you know, hunt a record and scrap the record and start over and no one will ever,
yeah,
hear it.
Yeah. I think when we go in, it's like we're working, like, we're going to create music that we don't have a lot of time to waste, yeah, between all the restaurants and, you know, the recipes and, like, maintaining. I mean, we really are traveling a lot for both music and for, like, business stuff, you know? So, like, when we work, it's like we really, really work. There's no, like, playing around, you know? Yeah. And I think a lot of I'm not saying, like, a lot of artists, but, like, I'm sure, like, a lot of artists, there's a lot more leisure, you know? Like, when we work, we're in the studio for 12 hours or 8 hours, whatever, and we're actually working on records, you
and
know?
And it's just us. We don't have, like, an entourage of,
yeah,
people with bottles and, like, people smoking and coming in and out of,
yeah,
the studio.
There's no entourage.
When we turn on this computer to work, like, we close the doors and we just, you know, kind of shut the world out. And we really focus on making, like, a good record. I'm not just, like, getting in there talking about, you know, what color shoes I have on and how much money is in my wallet right now. I'm like, thinking about
it's a job.
Impactful, you know.
Essentially, messages. Essentially, I mean, want to think about it. I mean, I know the word job, it has like a negative kind of like thing to it, but it's a job, you know, and you have to treat it as such if you're serious about it, you know, mm-hmm. which is why I'm able to run 3 restaurants and a digital agency and still tour and make music, you know. It's just you have to dedicate yourself, and that's something that you have to remind yourself every day. I mean, you can waste time, and we all waste time as humans, you know, but if you focus on the goal and you dedicate your time towards that goal, there's no reason why you can't achieve it, you know. My biggest thing is when someone says, I have no time. That's like the biggest insult, honestly. You can insult yourself when you're saying, well, I don't have any time. And that's the reason why I couldn't accomplish what I want to accomplish. And it's like, come on, man. That's a cop-out, you know?
Speaking of packing things in, you have a tour coming up in June. Where are you hitting?
West Coast.
Yeah, the West Coast again. They love us.
And the West Coast for a couple of shows. And then in September, we're going to the Middle East to play and to actually work with in a refugee camp in Bethlehem. V and I are going to work with some of the youth and kind of, you know, give them inspiration that there's more than their surrounding living situation at the moment, you know.
How did that come to be?
I did a workshop last year with an organization, and they brought me out to work with the kids, and then they just emailed me actually not too long ago, and they're like, hey, we want you to come back. And so I tied in, and we're already going to perform in Palestine anyways, so I tied in this with it as well. So, you know, we try to just maximize on all of our time that we're there.
So, Elizabeth is the king of maximizing time.
Yeah.
I'm talking like...
There's no downtime, you know?
What? I feel we're going to miss our airplane sometimes, like all the time.
No.
We get there just in time.
Yeah, there's always, you know, we a lot of structure, and we try to waste no time and try to, you know, maximize on what we have to do.
Yeah.
Make the best out of it.
Incredible. Well, we want to make sure we have time for one more song, but where can people find you, listen to the EPs, check out your tour dates?
You can find us on
thedramaduo.com.
Yeah, the Drama Duo, or you go to Spotify and type in drama.
Yeah.
Facebook, Instagram.
YouTube.
The whole thing.
Just look up the Drama Duo.
Yeah, or drama, yeah. Chicago, either one. Yeah.
Perfect. Well, we want to thank Chef Diana for being on the show as well. Thank you to Drama for joining us. We'll be back next week with a new episode of Snacky Tunes. What is the name of the last song you're going to play for us?
Safe House.
Amazing. Well, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week. Loving you.
you always want, that you cannot have. You push me away just to beg for me back, and darling,
talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.